This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Making financial decisions shouldn't feel like picking a TV show. Too many options, too much hype, and no way to know what's actually good. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast cuts through the clutter. Their finance journalists break through real-world money decisions with clear, research-backed insights. From investing to home buying to credit cards, the nerds help you navigate major financial decisions with confidence. Leave TV to fate. Leave your next financial move to the nerds. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Green from the Commercial Break Podcast. It's likely you've heard of the show if you're directly related to me or you follow our MySpace page. But I'm not here to talk to those three listeners. I'm here to appeal to people who haven't heard the show. Along with my co-host, Kristen Joy Hoadley, we're taking a deeper look at the topics that are affecting our youth today. Like, who are the people who are dating ghosts? Where did all these pickup artists come from? And why doesn't my preacher have a nicer private jet? We understand that these are the issues you really want to get to the bottom of. The Commercial Break is now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
From 2400 Sports, Odyssey, and Major League Baseball, this is the PBP Voices of Baseball.
We bring you the people who bring you the game.
Hello, 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 baseball people, and welcome into the PBP Voices of Baseball, our complete game episode here on a Tuesday. Means a nice full interview with a broadcaster of note. Dave Raymond of the Texas Rangers is our guy. And I gotta say, of all the unconventional paths we have documented with some folks, this guy might be the king of the unconventional path. Might be the king. Let's just say this. We don't even get into the fact that he was once traded by Mike Vec, because it ends up being too tangential and irrelevant to the conversation, which I absolutely loved, and I hope you will too. Dave Raymond, the TV voice of the Texas Rangers, tells us about a moment in the bleachers at Candlestick Park when his dream was born. And it comes a lot later than the moment has for so many others.
I was a sophomore and junior in college, I think, and went to the game with some buddies, and we were just having a good time. And I was definitely, the whole time in college, I was struggling to figure out a major, to figure out, you know, what I was going to do with my life. And I just remember sitting there and looking back, and I don't know if you remember old Candlestick, but they, you know, it was like a ballpark. It was like a big high school park set on this piece of land, and then a huge 4 or 5 story rectangular building behind it. And I think, you know, for the uninitiated, and look, I'm a huckleberry, you know, I grew up in Western Nebraska. I didn't know anything, but I saw that building, and it all of a sudden it connected to me, like, that building is the ball club. That's where there's an operation here. There's a, there are jobs and people. And I saw people walking around. It was a night game. I saw them walking around in the offices and using a Xerox and, you know, and then walking across to another office. I'm like, what are they doing? What's going on up there? I thought, they're working for the baseball team. So then my mind started going, like, well, what could I do to work for a baseball team? And total Costanza moment, right? Well, I like baseball. I like to talk about baseball. Maybe I can talk about baseball for a baseball team. Yeah, just complete stupidity. But sometimes that's what it takes, right? Is just not knowing. And so I started asking some questions, and here we are.
I like that you had the willingness to have that stupidity at that age, because a lot of us, like, the dream of doing what you do happens when you're still a kid, and that kind of willingness to have the dream is easier to access. I mean, so kudos for still having the willingness and the openness, frankly.
Yeah, well, Matt, you should talk to my wife, because I don't know if I'm so much embracing stupidity as much as I'm just living with it.
Hey, well, you know, if you don't have a choice, it's okay. Yeah. So, you know, it's amazing. That my favorite broadcasters are the ones who have a sense of humor and who have a personality. And for some people, it's like a lifelong kind of journey to let their personality come through. You know, I like to ask about how a great play-by-play person has to be both a technician and an entertainer. And people come at this from all different angles. You started as an entertainer before a technician. Would you agree with that?
I mean, I tried, right? I mean, I appreciate your perspective on this, by the way, because I feel very strongly about that very thing, right? That, yeah, we have to be technicians. We have to get the game right. You have to know the game, et cetera. And I love the history of the game. But I do think at its core, it's 2 to 3 hours a night of you just trying to keep people engaged and entertained. And I think that's a really, really big part of it. And it is the biggest challenge is to let the personality out, right? To allow yourself to be vulnerable and for people to criticize you or say something about you or pick a little bit at you. And that's difficult. It definitely does take time. But yeah, I guess when it comes to that sort of thing, I definitely jumped right into the deepest waters as an undergraduate. I had a couple of friends my freshman year convince me that I needed to do the little open mic stand-up comedy thing at the coffee house on campus at Stanford. And I was ill-prepared. I flopped. It was terrible, but also exhilarating. I loved it.
Hey, man, I love listening to comics tell stories of when they bomb. And there's still comics who love those experiences and feel like it's important to go out and bomb. You were on stage at the Purple Onion, weren't you?
Yes, yes. And so then eventually I started doing some open mic nights at the Purple Onion. I failed so badly on campus, I thought, well, I got to do that again. I mean, that wasn't quite as hurtful as it could be. So let's really reach the public with this nonsense. And so, yeah. Did a couple nights at the Purple Onion in San Francisco, which was a great old establishment. Been there forever.
There's a great Zach Galifianakis video. I think it's a 1 hour. It's the first time I ever saw Zach Galifianakis was live at the Purple Onion. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's legendary comedy hub.
You're right. And guys like Zach and there are plenty of others. As you mentioned, like Tig Notaro is a great one too, right? It's like the goal is to make people as uncomfortable as possible, it seems. And I mean, a lot of comedy is making people uncomfortable, right? You approach subjects that other people maybe won't feel comfortable talking about in public. And then you try to find the humor and make people laugh about it. And then some people, well, it's really not about confronting subjects. It's more about like, just legitimately making you uncomfortable. I was never quite there, at least not by design. That was never my goal. My goal was to make people laugh and to be smooth, but I ended up on the wrong side of that equation.
So once you have that moment in the bleachers and you add in who you are as a guy searching for his voice and a guy who's willing to go on stage and flop, then you got to get reps. Yeah. So the reps came self-propelled at first in the bleachers.
Yeah. Right? Well, yeah, we had a student radio station that did some games. And so I was, you know, a late bloomer. I came to this whole thing at the end of my college career. And so they told me, you know, well, engineer some games, work back at the studio and you'll get some reps. Well, I got like 2 innings by the time I was a senior. And that wasn't going to cut it. And so I had read enough and talked to enough people at this point that you just heard the stories of people going to the ballpark and recording games into the recorder. And so I did. And that was before we had things like iPhones and internet and all that other stuff. So, so I would traipse to Candlestick Park. And I would take all this equipment. It was like, you know, a little briefcase and then a backpack of stuff. I would set all this stuff up, most of which was probably unnecessary. But I'm up at the very top of the third deck and would just talk into the microphone. I kept scrolling the back of like a folder, like a manila folder. And I would get little tidbits and data off the scoreboard. And that's how I made it work. And I can still hear some of the tapes in my head, a Barry Bonds at bat. It was just, it was sloppy. There's one bit, and I can't remember if I found this recently or not, but I went back. I don't even really have many tapes anymore, but I was looking for this part where these kids were just roaming around the ballpark, and they saw me, and they came, and they were, 15 rows away. There's nobody in the section, and they're looking up at me, and then they would creep closer and closer, like, approaching a wild animal. And then finally they're like, "Hey, what are you doing?" And you hear me ruffling the microphone. I'm broadcasting the game. And then there'd be a little pause. Like, "You're not broadcasting the game." Oh, man.
As far as you know.
Damn, right in the middle of my inning, kid. I had some good stuff going here, too. So, but that's the charm and the fun of it back then.
But and those tapes, I mean, some of those Bleacher tapes would eventually get you your first gig.
Yeah, right? Yeah, they did. I had the school stuff, but it was no good. So it was that tape. And the first job I got in Sonoma County, it was an independent league team. This was coming right after the strike in '94. I sent them the tape. They brought me in. They interviewed me. And the owner of the team sat me down. And he was an old IBM guy. And so he was very straightforward and very calculated. And he was like, "We'd like to hire you to come work here. But I'm going to be really honest with you. You're not going to broadcast our games." I said, "Well, that's your opinion." and he's like, we're going to hire, like a real broadcaster. And I'm just thinking, like, I know, but I'll wear you down, And I did. I wore him down. I did the PA at home games. But then these announcers that they hired, these were legitimate professional broadcasters in the Bay Area. They weren't going to travel and do a minor league, independent league season. So at some point he realized, geez, maybe this guy is going to do my games. So they let me do the road games for a couple of years, and that's how it started.
There are many moments along the career for Dave Raymond that show that inability to let the dream go. It's like, "Oh, that's what you think. I'm not doing the games. You just wait, pal." So the Sonoma County Crushers, I saw a picture of you in a Slayer shirt with long hair. Was that your long hair or is that a wig? And please tell us about these bits that you were doing in the minors, because I mean, it's interesting because, look, Joe Davis was on the pod, right? Yeah. And Joe Davis told me when he was doing the Montgomery Biscuits in the minors, he would spend a game pretending to be Pat Summerall and another game pretending to be John Miller, another game as Musburger, like whatever. He was just kind of trying on different bits of voices in his minors so he could find his own voice. And there's a freedom that comes with the minors, or in your case, independent league. Sounds like you made use of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was, first of all, it was not my real hair.
Damn it.
You're looking at actually, I was complaining to my wife the other day about how I've got to get in and get a haircut before we hit the road again. This is just on, I can't manage this.
Yeah. There's no party anywhere in the front or the back.
Yeah, exactly. So that was definitely a bit. And so I can't remember why this happened, but this was about the time that, they came up with this stuff. What was it called? It was Click Something. But your PA systems now had like little audio and a computerized audio system. So you could put in walk-up songs for the hitters and that kind of thing. But it had, the sound of a window smashing if somebody hit a foul ball over the back. So my job as the PA announcer was to be the PA announcer, but then to play with this thing. Oh, my God. So and again, it was completely novel at the time. So I would just, the stupidest things, I would just play with it all day and people laughed. And it was like being at a comedy club because you could get the reaction of the fans and see what was working. And then for some reason, in between innings, when you do those little goofy promotions, the, you know, spin around the bat and all this other stuff, I would just go into characters. And I would, you know, like, all right, time for the fifth inning, and it's time for the dizzy bat race. So we'll welcome in, you know, some character to come in and do it, right? And so then I would do voices. It was like Robin Williams up there just doing voices and bits. And you know, people were laughing, and they loved it. So then I started adding the costumes. And it was a complete, like, vaudeville one-man show from the PA booth every night. And then that's when I think they started giving me home games at some point. They're like, yeah, maybe you can do the road games and the home games. Get him off the PA mic. Because it was it was an absolute shit show, if you will.
I mean, it is pretty amazing. So this is literally the entertainer that finds his way to the booth. It really is, with the dreams of it. And I mean, that sense of play. I mean, my favorite broadcasts are still the ones that have that sense of play readily available at the ball game. So it's, I mean, that must be like a comfortable place for you, even doing Rangers games right now. When something goofy happens, you're like, oh, I know what to do with this.
I mean, that's why every night I'm looking for, I don't want to be in the way of the game, but I am. Like, it's a successful night if I walk away chuckling, like, oh, I got away with one, or, you know, that tickled the guys in the truck or something, right? I'm always looking for one. And if it's coming back from break, if it's heading to break, if it's just getting a little sly shot off on something at some point, it's kind of the goal. I mean, that's really the goal. You want to make sure your calls are right and everything, but mostly I want to amuse somebody at some point in the night. It's just, I can't help it. You know, and I don't know what it says about me. And oddly, I worry about that. I mean, you know, you read enough about people and psychology, and Lord knows we're all staring at our own belly buttons all the time. And I'm like, what happened to me? Like, I swear to God, my parents loved me. They really did, Matt. Like, I was the middle child. I was getting more attention than anyone needed. So what it is that makes you continue to, like, look for a laugh and everything, I don't know.
Look, I could charge you a copay, or you could charge me a copay for this session as desire. But my dad's 91, and I just saw him, and we're like, what's something you like about yourself? And he said, I make people laugh, and I have my whole life. I mean, it's just in some of us. Believe me, I'm a talk show host, and I'll walk away from a show thinking, boy, that was funny at 3:45. I wonder if anybody heard that one. So now, Dave, give me something. Give me something from a ball game this year that you're like, oh, man, we got away with one. Or one of those moments where just made you smile.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know about a ball game this year. And I'm always hesitant to do that, like real recent stuff, because I don't want people looking for my tomfoolery or cutting me off at the path.
Understood.
But give
me one from whenever then.
Yeah. So there are a couple that stand out. I was in a job interview a few years ago, and somebody asked me, like, you know, well, what was one of your best calls or favorite moments in your broadcasting career? And I was like, two moments I'm really proud of. One was April Fool's Day. On, like, it was the second day of the season. We were in San Diego at the time. This was years ago when I was with Houston. And Kaz Matsui was our second baseman. He was hurt to start the year. And I don't know, you know, you didn't have a lot of long conversations with Kaz because he didn't really speak English. But I went down, I got his translator and everything. And I said, hey, listen, I got an idea for the pregame interview today. What would you guys say to, I ask you elaborate, poorly worded questions with just, like, if an English teacher tried to diagram the sentence, there'd be no chance, right? And then he answers me in Japanese without a translator, as if he knows what I'm saying. I respond as if I understand his Japanese, and back and forth we go. And they're like, oh my God, Kaz loves it. And his translator was like, in Japan, April Fool's Day is a huge thing. We love it. So we're all over it. So I told him, like, the basic idea of what I would ask, three questions, right? One about the injury, one about the rehab or something, and one about this year. And so I put together these ridiculous questions. He goes off and answers long-winded in Japanese, and I would chuckle in the middle of his answers and come out and pretend, oh, man. Yeah. You know, I actually hadn't thought of it that way, Kaz, but that is a good point. You know, and on we go. And then we just played it. My partner didn't, he had no idea what was going on. He didn't even know I was doing it. And he just looks at me at some point in the middle of the thing. He's like, what is going on? And we come out of break and he asked me about it. So I got to tell everybody, like, it's an April Fool's joke. And, but still for weeks, people would come up to me. They're like, what the hell was that? What was that interview? I don't understand. You know, he was speaking Japanese and we couldn't understand what he was. I'm like, yes, that was the point. But that was one of my favorite moments anyway.
That's awesome. I was looking through.
Oh, also, for a hard... I should tell you, Matt, I didn't get that job.
Why not? What the hell is that about?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's amazing because some of those moments that I referenced in your career where you were like, well, I guess that was that. You know, it's funny. I talked to Johnny Dosko. You know Johnny?
I love Johnny.
I love Johnny too. And I really loved that conversation. And that's a guy who in his 50s, like, went to his wife and said, honey, I think it's over. You know, I think it's AAA and that's all it's ever going to be. And let's just relax and not worry about it. And within a year, he got his call and there he is with the A's. And you, Dave, like, you and your wife, you know, bought into the nannying and tutoring company. And you bought into the franchise and you're like, all right, I think I'm done. And then what, within a year, or within a year, the Rangers call and offer you some spring games. And what you had to feel like a drug addict that had weaned himself off of the teat.
Yeah. Yeah. My wife saved my career at least twice. When I was in the minor leagues at some point, I thought it's time. I've given it a good run and it's not going to happen. I was probably still in my 20s and she, long story, but a broken down car and all this stuff. And it was a dead battery all the time. And we'd have to park on a downhill in San Francisco and then roll it and then pop the clutch. And so she's with me. I'm like, car's dead. We roll it. We get going. We're driving around for 20 minutes. And I'm telling her, I'm like, what are we doing? Right. I mean, what the hell's going on here? Enough is enough. We've tried it. And so she made me pull over. We went into this little bar called Left at Albuquerque. She got some shots of tequila and she set them down. And she asked me, she's like, what if I told you won't broadcast a big league game until you're 40 years old? I'm 28, 29 at the time. I'm like, well, I don't know. 40? She's like, yeah. I was like, that'd be unreal. Are you kidding me? I'd be in the big leagues. She said, yeah. That would be amazing. She's like, then no, we're going to keep going. This is stupid. You're so young. That's so far off. You're absolutely going to be there. Don't worry about it. Okay. So fast forward, I'm in the big leagues and we've done 7 years in Houston. I've had a little time with the Giants, a little time with the Orioles, but I get fired by Houston. New ownership comes in, they clean house and change everything. And I'm in a little bit of a panic and I try to do something. I do some stuff for Major League Baseball and I'm freelancing everywhere, and I burn myself out. I get the shingles 1 year. I swear to God, I was going to die at the winter meetings in Orlando, happiest place on earth. And I wake up with a shingles, and I'm like, "This is unreal. I'm done."
This period that you're talking about resonates with me because I had a moment in LA in my 30s where I was unemployed and couch surfing and doing about 9 things at once. And it seems like you were doing about 8-9 jobs at once there for a while when you were at MLB.
Yeah. Yeah, it was brutal. And I was sleeping on my brother's couch in Manhattan. And I would stay there for 12 days, go home for 2 days to Houston to my family. And then around and around we went. Meanwhile, I was doing a Houston Texans show in Dallas. My family was living in Houston. I was working for MLB in New York, traveling, working for them. I was in Orlando. But then I was also doing a basketball package for SNY in the A-10. The day I got the shingles, the doctor in the hotel was like, you've got to stay here, rest, whatever. I said, well, I've got a flight in like a couple of hours. Could hardly move. I go to New York, get the rental car, go to the gym, and do the game.
With the shingles.
With the shingles. And I mean, I could hardly stand. And I'm sure I was peaked. It was terrible. But, yeah, I just had to keep it moving. I felt like I had to keep these jobs, stay relevant, stay in the game. So anyway, I'm cracking. And I decided, like, that's it. I'm out. I'm done. What am I doing? I feel like I have to prove myself to people all the time. It gets exhausting, right? You're like, I think I'm okay. But I'm tired of having to convince everybody of that. And it's just, and to take their judgment, what the hell do they know? They've never even done it, right? These people who are hiring. And so I was done. I quit. We bought into this franchise business, and I had just set up the LLC and sent in the first payment. And within about 2-3 weeks, I'm planning and doing stuff. I get an email out of the blue, unsolicited, had no idea there was an opportunity here in Arlington from John Blake. And I'd known John over the years. I would talk to him from time to time. He'd see me at the winter meetings and stuff and just shake his head. Anyway, it's like, you want to do some spring training games? And I resisted. I fought it. I was like, I can't. I'm trying to quit, right? But I told my wife, I'm like, this business costs more money than I thought. So let me go do these 12 games, right? It'll be a little bit of seed money, help keep us going. Okay. So I went and did those games. Nothing the rest of the year. Didn't hear from him again. I was like, well, those must not have gone very well. So no big deal. We get to November, and all of a sudden there's a White Sox job, and I go interview for that, and John finds out. He's like, hey, I was going to talk to you about coming to work for us. Well, I'm here. You know, let's talk. And so he offered me a job, and off we went. Now it's like year 10 here. And it just kind of came out of nowhere. And then I was like, well, no, I guess I don't have to quit. Like you say, like that someone stuck that needle back in the arm, and here you are. And I can't imagine not doing it. You know, it's hard to imagine not having this job.
What do you love most about broadcasting big league games?
Well, when I was out, that was interesting, right? So I was out there for that little window. You confront that. Like, what do you miss the most? And I'll be honest, the thing you miss the most is the camaraderie of the guys in the business. It's my lunches and chats with Jim Deshays when we come through Chicago. It's seeing Johnny Dosko when we go now to Sacramento. It's my time with John Miller and Dave Fleming and Kruk and Kipe in San Francisco. You know, it's like, that's what I miss the most. And then talking to managers and coaches, honestly. The game's changed a little bit. Players are less interested in talking, they just really are. You still build some relationships, and they're fun, and I'm fascinated by them and what they do, but they work hard and they're focused. It's not like it used to be. But the coaches and managers are just amazing. You know, you can talk ball with them all day long, and they love it. And they love to tell stories, and they like to talk about the game from the night before. And that's what I love. I mean, I feel like that is the job. The job is to hang around and chat. I love this stuff, you know, bumping into you in Chicago, and, you know, we're just in the dining room debating whether we have more chicken thighs in the Wrigley press box, because it's there every day.
Yeah. Following your logic, by the way, and I love, the job is to hang around and chat. If that's not a pull quote, I don't know what is. And that's part of the dream. But the Wrigley dining room chicken thigh deal that they got must have been tremendous. That a bulk, some kind of bulk discount that allowed chicken thighs every day.
Let's just say Joe DiMaggio's family will need to be there at some point this summer to acknowledge the streak and pass on the torch, because that is phenomenal. And it reminds me of the minor leagues, man. In Omaha, we used to go to, when I was in with the Iowa Cubs, we go to Omaha, and the first day in, and it was perfect because this would be about the time of year too, they'd have a big ham, and they'd slice off ham for, oh, it's just like Easter. This is great. You know, here's a big ham and all this other fixings. The next day, there'd be like some sort of ham sliced something or other. You're like, oh, that's a lot like the ham we saw yesterday. And the third day, you're like, I'm going to pass. I'm good. I'm in ham.
You don't want the ham soup on day four?
Yeah, exactly.
not interested? Yeah. It'd be great if a chef named Bagby Jr. was the one that ended the streak. But that's just for the deep baseball heads out there. Dave, is there a specific item that you like to always have with you in the booth? It can be a good luck charm or a talisman or anything that has to be there for you to do the job.
Boy, that's an interesting question. I mean, no, I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
Okay. How do you keep score then? That's where I pivot to. What kind of pens and pencils? I always like to ask this because Marty Brenneman told me he used to use the number one pencils, which of course existed. I never knew they did.
Wow.
Before the number two and the pencil. And then he couldn't find them anymore. So he had to order them by the case at one point, the number one pencils. So what do you use and how do you do it these days?
Yeah. So we've all been there, right? We've all gone through that and it's charming. It's a little bit confining. But you love it. I actually kind of love that part of it, but I've lost that. And I've lost it because about seven or eight years ago, I went to scoring on the iPad and I did it as a lark. I resisted and resisted and I saw people doing it. I was like, I don't know. It just seems like a sacrilege, you know? You got to have the book. You got to tote it around. You got to fret over it. You got to, you know, like the whole, how can I possibly do a game if I can't flip back 14 pages to see how this guy did in that one game? And people show you on the iPad, well, actually, watch this. Boop. Oh, okay, well, that looks pretty easy, doesn't it? But so I got the iPad. I said, I needed an iPad. I'll try that. I'll put it on here, and I'll score one night simultaneously both ways. About fifth inning of that game, the book was in the garbage can, and I was like, this is really fun. It's a super fun way to score. It's really easy. It gives me so much flexibility. It's great. So whether it's, you know, substitutions, extra innings, whatever the case, and even just the ease of seeing both ledgers, you know, the visiting and the home team at the same time, it's just super easy and it's compact and we're losing space. It seems like by the day in these press boxes as they move us higher and higher and shrink the spaces. So it's really worked and been very helpful that way, but perfect games, no hitters, cycles, you know, great moments. Maybe Bruce Bochy is going to pass Dusty Baker here, hopefully this weekend, for seventh place all time on manager's wins list. It'd be cool to have a guy sign your scorebook or something, right? Or just have it. Or what if one day the Hall of Fame called and said, hey, we want your scorecard from this particular day. It's like, well, I'll send it to you as a PDF.
Yes.
That sucks. You know, like that's like that part kills me. And I feel it like every day when something happens, I'm like, oh man, it's like, it's an electronic version of it. It lacks a little of that authenticity. So I've lost that, but there used to be a mechanical pencil that I had to have that had the little button down by the index finger.
Okay.
That's where you click it instead of the clicking at the top.
Oh, yeah. You need that button a little further down, right?
Yeah. I liked it down there by the index finger and a really fine point and all that stuff. And then the proper eraser. I was fussy about that. And I was absolutely a pencil only guy. I couldn't believe people scored in pen and used color. I thought that was just insanity. I'm like, what if you will make a mistake. How do you correct for that? And I'll be damned if I'm going to haul around whiteout or something like that.
Yeah, understood. Two things. The PDF exhibit at the Hall of Fame is beautiful. They've got a whole separate room for that now. It's quite something. And I'll send this clip to Marty Brenneman and report back to you.
That's the type of stuff that will like hurt their soul, right? And I get it because it hurts mine every day. Kills me.
Nah, time marches on, man. My dad is better on Facebook than I am. That's for damn sure. Tell me a competitive moment. We talked about some fun moments, but tell me whether it's a Seager homer, an Adolis Garcia, or whatever, a big moment in the Rangers' run to the World Series. It's a big moment that really felt like it came together in a way that you feel grateful to have been a part of? First thing that comes to your mind that you're comfortable with people hearing?
Well, there are two great moments that I've been fortunate to witness and call. And one was Adrian Beltre's 3,000th hit.
Everybody on their feet at Globe Life Park. The 3-0. Bouncer, big hit in the left field. Around second, heading to third, Mazzara. Beltre goes for two, and it's a stand-up double. And there it is, number 3,000 for Adrian Beltre.
You don't get those all the time, especially for your guys. And so that was pretty special. And I was like, I've never been a person to script or have a pat call or anything like that. So I really wanted to resist that. But at the same time, leading into it, I was nervous as hell. I didn't want to mess that up. And I thought, you know, you've got one chance to, you know, really highlight the moment with maybe something meaningful, what it meant for him, for the Rangers, whatever, like give it context. So I fretted about that for a while. And it kind of made me nervous. I ended up doing, I think, kind of nothing about it, right? And I remember laying out for a minute and a half or so. But what I also remember is the moment happens, huge crowd, you know, here it comes. Boom, it's a double into left field. And he goes to second base with a double, which was also fitting because that's what he does. And it was great and exciting. The electricity in the house was off the charts. My family was there. And I couldn't get over the fact that I was doing this. You know, I mean, it's one thing to call a game. That's amazing. But then to be a part of a big moment like this was crazy. And the moment I knew it was crazy was the call ended and we're watching. And seeing what the team's doing, watching little shots on the monitor. And then it was about time for me, you know, to put it in the book. I was going to write it in now. And my hand was shaking so badly, I couldn't. Like, just the adrenaline of the moment and the crowd and all of that was so much. I couldn't calm the hand down for a while. That was amazing. Because I've never, you know, you don't know how you're going to react physically to something like that. So that was phenomenal to me. I just I'll never forget that sensation. The other moment for me was the Matt Cain perfect game in San Francisco. And I tell the story from time to time. It'll be a moment and a day never matched. Willie Mays always down in the clubhouse in San Francisco and made it a point to go down and see him that day and just chat with him. I end up down there for hours with him. And it's getting close to game time. I got to get upstairs, but he doesn't want to stop the conversation. It's going on and on. And I keep saying, Willie, I gotta run. The game's about to start. At this point, I'm not going to eat. I haven't written anything in my scorebook. I've got nothing. And we're, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever from game time. And I'm thinking, I got to get upstairs. So finally I'm like, Willie, this is it. I'm gone. Got to go. And he's like, well, we need to keep this conversation going. I said, well, we come back right after the All-Star break. And he's like, well, you got to come over to the house. I said, done. I'll come over to the house. And so then I called my wife. I was like, hey, we're planning a vacation over the All-Star break. We're coming to San Francisco and we're going to hang out here. And then you guys can come to the Giants games and stuff. And I'm going to go hang out with Willie. And so I was just floating. I floated up to the press box. And then the game started. You know, there's a first pitch from Kane and it's outside ball 1-2. Matsui, you know, and I'm writing it in there as we go along. Perfect game happens. San Francisco is a great environment. Wonderful moments where I did my first games were with San Francisco.
Kane with that look of determination starts his windup. His 1-2 pitch is grounded toward third. Arias has it, stumbles, throws to first, and he did it. Matt Kane is the first pitcher in the 128 years of the Giants franchise to pitch a perfect game. My goodness, what a night for Matt Cain, being mobbed by his teammates on the field. History tonight here in San Francisco. Amazing.
Game ends and I'm just kind of buzzing over the whole thing. And then I go hang out with Krug and Kipe and John and Dave, who are all dear friends. And we had a few beers and we watched the umpires come out and take a picture on the mound. We watched people come out, dig up the mound because they're going to send it to the Hall of Fame. Watch Matt Cain come out with his wife and take a picture on the mound. It's dark. I mean, the lights are down. We go out to the parking lot, end up chatting with the umpires about what they felt during the game. Just hung out there forever. And that was and is the most glorious day any one man could ever have in the game of baseball, from start to finish. And this is the first time I've ever told that story without, honest to God, sobbing like a child. Because it is, it's way more than when I was a kid, what I could have dreamed of. I mean, it's just amazing. It was just amazing.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't get better than having a conversation with Willie and then he invites you to the house.
Yeah.
I guess a perfect game is, yeah, that's an outrageous day. And you went to the house?
Yep. Went to the house. Dave Fleming and I went and hung out, and he lives in Atherton, this beautiful city. Lived in Atherton, I should say. And I mean, just, you know, we don't have the time, but an amazing experience to talk about his career and just shoot the breeze. And he showed us all sorts of memorabilia. And he's got this one building. It's like a huge office freestanding out on his property. It was full of everything, you know, batting crowns, gold gloves, bats from All-Star games, photographs, autographs, jerseys.
Oh my God.
Everything. I mean, and he's a baseball nut, and he's a, he was a beautiful man. He was a beautiful man, man. Awesome.
Dave Raymond, that's a perfect place to stop. Thank you so much. Appreciate the time. Great to get to know you like this. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me. This is always fun, right? This is what, you know, hanging out and chatting. That's what we do.
That's the gig. That's the gig, hanging out and chatting. That's the pull quote. That's the tagline right there. Dave Raymond, what a pleasure to get to know that guy. How about his Willie Mays day? Is that the dream? Unreal. And the understandable toggle between present tense and past tense as he's talking about Willie and his day at the house. How that guy could possibly not be a living person right now. The way that we think about him and feel about him, it's quite something. Thanks so much for listening to the PBP Voices of Baseball. What a pleasure. Thursday will be our spot starter episode where we will, as always, highlight the top five calls of the week. We need your input. You can email us, pbptop5@gmail.com, or you can find me on Twitter at Matt Spiegs, MattSpieges. And send us at any point of any day a call that you think is awesome. Video, audio, MLB. And we will catalog and put in our top five on Thursday. Our producer is Robbie Triano. My producer emeritus is Ryan Porth. We just get in the title so we can ask him to do stuff. My collaborator is James Vickery. The music for the PBP comes from Kurt Morrison of Tributosaurus. This is an Odyssey podcast in collaboration with Major League Baseball. Find us on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts. And on our YouTube page where you can see the PBP Top 5 every Friday morning at 7 o'clock Central. The PBP, Voices of Baseball. We bring you the people that bring you the game.